Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. My guest today is Dr. Lauren Penny, who is one of my WCAA friends. And Dr. Penny is here to talk about forced mental health treatment. So, Lauren, tell us a little bit about what you're doing this weekend and why you're doing it.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm participating in the 37th annual Bastille Day demonstration hosted by the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance. Right now, there are activities going on all over the world, all through July, celebrating the human spirit and breaking the silence about psychiatric oppression. We are actually camped out for 72 hours in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health at 44 Holland Avenue in Albany, New York. And we're here for 72 hours because that's how long anyone can be picked up by psychiatric SWAT and taken in for evaluation to determine whether or not they would be institutionalized or released under law. Pretty much nationally, that's pretty much a standard. My personal interest and investment in this is that when I was 15, I was locked up in a psychiatric institution, and my experiences there have motivated me to dedicate my life to eliminating human rights violations that are carried out in the name of psychiatric, quote-unquote, help, and to call attention to the fraud of psychiatry and the lack of actual any scientific evidence that is held for it. I know this could be like a big, no pun intended, but pill to swallow for a lot of people. So I'm happy to talk through all of this. But there's a long history of people dating back to the 19th century, at least, or probably before then, actually, in Europe. But in the United States, dating back to the 19th century, of people warning against the state-sponsored system of systemic torture and oppression.
Now, you have a PhD. Can you tell everybody what your PhD is in?
Sure. I got my PhD through the Graduate Center of City University of New York's PhD program in environmental psychology. My research really has focused on my dissertation was about how people are silenced and retaliated against when they speak out against psychiatry.
Well, you used a phrase just a few minutes ago, psychiatric oppression. Can you describe what that means?
So it's at its base, when a person, there are several ways a person can get involved with the psychiatric industry. What we've known for over a century is that abuse and violence toward a person is often a contributing factor to somebody feeling like they need something, what we now call trauma, physical, sexual, psychological, emotional abuse, poverty, war, discrimination, a whole variety of different things that happen to a person throughout their life that can culminate in either daily ongoing building up of trauma or an incident that is so traumatic that it changes the course of somebody's experience. They've known that for over 100 years. Freud knew that. Freud's original theory, and I'm no fan of Freud, I should put that out there, but his original theory was called seduction theory. And what he saw was that these women that were being diagnosed with quote-unquote hysteria were really survivors of sexual assault. And he put that forward, and he was basically laughed out of medicine, and Martha wouldn't marry him unless he was a famous, successful doctor. And so he rewrote his theory as the Oedipus complex, that his, you know, adult, quote-unquote, patients were having fantasies about having sex with their parents when they were children. And that it, to this day, is still, the Oedipus complex is still what is taught, even though it's a total fraud. So trauma and inequality and oppression in general in a society are things that can cause somebody to feel like they need to seek something. So some people seek out something because they feel they need something. But more commonly what happens is somebody else assigns that person as needing help, and the person themselves don't necessarily see it that way. And the help that the field of psychiatry has granted is deeply rooted in the pharmaceutical industry and other types of money-producing entities. I mean, you know, there's literally billions of state tax dollars donated to psychiatry in this country. It's big business. So that's one motivator. And then social control as the other motivator. You know, I'm 45 now, right? So I was locked up in 88 when I was 15. The system has expanded so much over the last 30 years. And by law, the evaluation and assessment of all children that is occurring, and in places like New York City, all women who are pregnant, that starts a process of we really have a generation of children that are coming up now that will not know what it means to not have seen a psychiatrist. Seeing a psychiatrist will be as basic as seeing a primary care doctor. And it was by design. In 1999, there was, or 98 or 97, somewhere around there, there was a intention to eliminate the, quote, discrimination that people experience because of a psychiatric label by labeling everybody. And the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which has been discounted by many in leadership roles and non-leadership roles, is literally 95% of the population can be diagnosed some way or another through that manual, which is not based on science. It is based on a subjective list of criteria that people literally vote on. And I would point people to Paula Joan Kaplan's work, They Say You're Crazy, and her more recent work around looking at how the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual and labels are created and what she did to expose that. Dr. Paula Joan Kaplan, you can get her, I think it's paulajkaplan.net is her website. And so, you know, there's a tremendous amount of research that people who have spoken out against the psychiatric industry or questioned it even are then challenged and silenced themselves. So even people who are in leadership roles in the academy and other kinds of organizations, when they take a stand or even a question to the authority of psychiatry, they are then also dismissed and having their power taken away from them.
Labeled.
But when somebody is locked up, the process of psychiatric oppression, which is kind of where you had asked me to go, and I hope this gives a little bit of a context, is that somebody's personhood is literally stolen from them, and it's by design. Irving Goffman, in 1961, after going undercover at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in D.C., really exposed this process of a two-stage process that turns a person into a mental patient. And that feeling of one's sense of self isn't only about denial of what may or may not have happened to a person or what situation they may or may not have experienced in the context that they were coming out of. But it also really seriously curtails, if not completely eliminates, a possibility for a future. So very often when people wind up getting psychiatrized, one of the things that happens is that they almost immediately get put on a trajectory for disability, and they're told that they can't work or they shouldn't work. If you're in a forced situation or an institutionalized situation, very often people lose their jobs and their houses because not many of us have more than a month, if that, it's rent. So if you're institutionalized for 3 weeks and you don't have, haven't worked, then you've now lost your apartment and your housing, or housing may have been an issue to begin with. And economics, capitalism, I mean, this is all, I mean, you can't have this conversation without addressing these things, right? But it's a stealing of one's identity and a reassignment as patient. And my analogy, which is not popular with some people, particularly those in power, is that this is modern slavery, where one's life, liberty, and for psychiatry particularly, where one's life, liberty, and fortune is taken away by those in power. And literally, while somebody is mandated into either group therapy or institutions or group housing or whatever, they're creating jobs for the people who are now their overseers, and at a tremendous loss of life. There's a 25 to 30 year loss of life for people who are on psychiatric drugs, as compared to people who aren't, once controlled for poverty and suicide. These are startling numbers. If that we court order it, and people think that none of this is, that this has all gone away, but shock treatment is one of the things that the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance has focused on, trying to call attention to in society and putting a moratorium on and ending. But they still use shock treatment, ECT, electroconvulsive treatment, coursing electricity through somebody's brain to cause a grand mal seizure, which requires now general anesthesia, which carries an inherent risk of death, painkillers, muscle relaxers, not eating for 12 hours before the procedure 3 times a week. Women who are pregnant are now being given shock treatment on a regular basis because the SSRIs are known to cause such birth defects in developing fetuses. So I don't know how they think that that's okay for a pregnant woman. Though it is court-ordered in New York State, it is used on children in New York State, and shock treatment is most, the person most subjected to shock treatment is a woman over 60 years of age. So there's women who may be in adult homes or in institutions who may not have family or whose families may not be knowledgeable about what the truth of psychiatry is. Memory damage, the FDA has released literally pages of known damage that shock treatment does. Brain damage, body damage, broken bones, slipped discs. Death, obviously, as a potential effect of this, but the memory loss, and the FDA is trying to drop it from a Class 3 experimental device because it was existed prior to the FDA, right? So it was brought in as a device that eventually, and one of the things that Obama's administration said is that all of the experimental devices either needed to be taken off the market, if not proved safe or effective, or proved safe and effective. So the FDA is trying to downgrade the shock device to a Class 2 device, which would put it in the same category as condoms or eyeglasses or wheelchairs, and specifically for people who are diagnosed with quote-unquote depression, which is the medicalization of the human experience of sadness, even profound sadness and loss. But part of what the Alliance has always worked toward is creating the idea of advocacy for people who are involved with psychiatry, but also self-help and mutual support as alternatives to this medicalization of our experiences. And that's one of the reasons why, in addition to speaking out to break the silence about psychiatric oppression, we also celebrate the human spirit.
Now, you and I both live in New York State. When you talk about these issues, are you talking about an issue primarily in New York State, or is this a nationwide issue?
It's an international issue. it is all expensive. As a matter of fact, the World Health Organization has been trying to bury a report for, I don't know, over a decade already, I guess, and I guess they pretty successfully buried it. But they showed that in developing countries, the recovery rate for people who were assigned with schizophrenia was much, much greater than, and much, much quicker, much, much better than in industrialized countries, particularly the U.S. And one of the things that developing countries do not have that the U.S. does have is psychiatry. And so there is psychiatry pretty much across the board denies any human experience or context as to what could be the root of somebody being where they are. And it's not to say that people don't experience extreme states or have desperate moments or struggle. It's not denying those experiences by saying that psychiatry is a fraud. What is a fraud of psychiatry is the way it is presented as a medical scientific field when it just simply is not.
You know, you used the word depression a couple of minutes ago, and as you know, and many of my listeners know, that I am keen on the issue of the student loan debt crisis. Well, when somebody gets into a financial hardship, they tend to become depressed. Does the financial hardship of student loan and what happens in the mental health area, do they go hand in hand, would you say?
Well, I couldn't say conclusively, but I could say without doubt, particularly for those who wind up in the state system, that economics is a core issue that is being battled. There are not involuntary outpatient commitment programs, court-ordered psychiatry in Chappaqua, right? These are situations that are aimed at people who are struggling in poverty or just trying to make it. The economic situation, but without doubt, alters our experience. The money doesn't, you know, buy you love, but it does make living in the world a lot easier. And it's not to say that people who have money don't have extreme emotional kinds of responses and states are protected from having bad things happen to them. But certainly the financial strife that people experience affects our well-being. And you know, there's that old saying, you know, what's the difference between a crazy person, you know, quote-unquote crazy person and a quote-unquote eccentric person, and it's like the difference is how much money they have, right? And people with money can buy their way out of anything. So people who are getting psychiatrized in prison, which is one of my real big interests and focused futures that I'm going to be working on, doing a 13-week series on WCAA that'll air on WCAA on prison psychiatry. So, you know, if you get picked up on seven charges and they say, oh, well, we'll knock you down to just trespassing, and you don't have money for a lawyer, and you're like, well, that sounds good to me, and you just plead guilty to that, and then you get picked up again, and they say, well, you already have a record, so we're not going to do anything for you, right? Whereas somebody who can afford a lawyer can, you know, not get any charges at the front and work themselves up. So it's a completely, the whole system is rooted in disparity and inequality, and capitalism requires that. Capitalism requires a portion of the population to be in poverty. It's a necessary factor of capitalism. And the state, and that's why then social control, because that's how the state then controls the populations that it's overseeing, and does it very often under the guise of this is benevolent. Look, we're giving you housing, we're giving you transportation, we're giving you all this stuff. There's an entirely segregated system for people who are psychiatrized: transportation, work, food, education. entirely other systems. This is a huge state-sponsored, organized industry, and that people may not profit in terms of, you know, windfall, you know, profits from business, but there are accolades, there is power, there is access, there is political leverage that people gain. It's not just money as the only power base that is encouraged by this. And, you know, and every psychiatrist knows all of the potential risks and benefits of drugs, and every psychiatrist does not tell the people that they're involved with what those are. And if they don't know, then they shouldn't have their licenses. I mean, it's like you don't get to claim ignorance to this as that. So for centuries, when you look historically as to how the institutions have devolved over the years, but you know, when you look back to the days of bleeding and torture chambers, steam huts, wrapping people in cold blankets and leaving them to be steamed until the blankets, cold wet blankets, and steam them until the blankets dry, baths of surprises where people are like literally walked upon something and then the floor falls out and they fall into a big bucket of water. The tranquilizer chair where somebody is sat with their arms strapped to the chairs, their legs strapped to the chairs, with a box over their head and a hole cut out in the seat for them to defecate or urinate if they need to, and left there for days on end. These places and the techniques of whether they were called alienists or now psychiatrists have consistently been brutal and abusive and torture. And the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture, which the United States is party to, has said that some of the main practices of psychiatry may constitute torture, particularly shock treatment, restraint, solitary confinement, and the adverse behavioral interventions like skin shocks, which are still being used at the Judge Rottenberg Center in Massachusetts. So it's so complicated, and there's so much money, and there are so many people. And then you have people who really need and need things that they deservedly should have. And so they go to the system thinking that they're going to get help, and they wind up getting, in that process, some level of damage. And just because somebody has, and I want to make this really clear, not everybody has had this kind of experience. But because somebody hasn't had this experience doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So to deny psychiatric oppression is to, like, deny other forms of oppression. But young people, you know, you ask college debt, young people are in extreme jeopardy inside of this. We have a generation of people now who have been grown up told that, you know, what they experience and what their diagnosis is makes what makes them special, that it's a good thing, that it's a wonderful thing, that they should love their illness. And that is a detrimental thing inside of itself. And because of the Americans with Disabilities Act and other efforts, the IDEA to include people with disabilities in education and higher education particularly, we have more and more people coming into the educational system to get degrees who are now also in this process of re-justifying what's happened to them. And so it's even harder now to break through the idea that a label does not identify you or define you, because people have been told that this is who they are and they should love it. And then trying to break that is near impossible, not impossible, but it's very difficult to have people who have spent their entire lives thinking that this is what makes me who I am, then challenge whether or not it really is a legitimate thing. But I want to, just in case your guests and listeners don't know, there is no biological test for any diagnosis. There's no brain scan. There's no blood test. There is no genetic knowledge of anything that they can say with any specificity that this is what is, you know, quote-unquote depression or schizophrenia or eating disorder or math problems or snoring or any of these things, because they are all in the diagnostic manual, right, every single thing I just said. So it's a, and then it's subjectively subjectively crafted. So if your psychiatrist, like the diagnosis for a hypomanic episode includes having sex with multiple partners, making risky business investments, not sleeping, talking too much, a variety of different things. So if you have a different set of values or come from a different culture than the person who is assigning you, your behavior may seem to them, because it's all subjectively assessed, as inappropriate. If somebody believes that you don't have sex, if the psychiatrist believes you don't have sex before you're married, and you've just told them that you've interacted sexually with two people in the last week, they're not going to see that as you being sexually liberated. They're going to see that as you being in a hypomanic episode, because it's that subjective cultural values kind of base that also runs under it, right? And then part of what happens is that the labels allow people to not take responsibility for their actions and feel that this is, oh, I finally have an answer as to why I'm this way. How wonderful. Look, this is what it is. And then they're done and they can continue being that way. And what we know from a trauma model is that when people heal from what has happened to them, or their political thought and ideology isn't attacked, right, because that also is a piece of what can happen. Somebody has different political values, religious ideas, whatever, than their family or the immediate people around them, they also then mm-hmm. can be disparaged as, you know, being, you know, insane. So it's all very complicated, but the end result is that in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual itself, it says that if the person denies the condition that they have been assigned, that is the evidence of it. And they call that anadignosia. It's pretty horrifying that if a doctor says to you, well, you're depressed, and you say, no, I'm not, I'm just kind of sad and I'm not upset. And they say, no, you're depressed. And you say, no, I'm not. And they say, well, that's the evidence that you are. What fight do you have? And then if it's in a place of where you don't have money or access and you're in need of services, or they suggest you're in need of something, you're then, you know, forcibly committed to an institution, or what happens more modernly now, in a situation of involuntary outpatient commitment, where if you don't comply with whatever they say, you're then locked up against your will.
Wow. You know, you said an awful lot today, Lauren, but we have somebody on the line who has been patiently listening. Would you like to share your thoughts?
Sure. First of all, I just want to thank Lauren because of all our outreach workers in psychiatric rights. Lauren has been the most consistently clear about the central location of psych oppression in all the oppressions, whether that be gender, race, economic oppression, colonialism, that psychiatric oppression is the big cop who goes and gets everybody. And that's just true. And I wanted to just mention a couple of things maybe that got glossed over. One is that, you know, just an illustration of this is, did you know that domestic violence survivors are out there fighting to retain custody rights, because when they're locked up for PTSD for having been beat up, their partners, the ones who are accused, are the ones who get the custody of the children. This is a social pattern. You know, why would you do that to an abused woman? That's what they do. You know, and that's psychiatry does that. It says these people have psychiatric care. We can now take their children because they're obviously unfit. But, you know, domestic violence survivors, give me a break, right? So they're willing to get anybody, you know, with psychiatry if it's convenient to do that, and it's big business. But I also want to point out this other connection that I think isn't offered often enough, and that is that certain communities are deluged with neurotoxins, CNS toxins that are coming from the environment. And the U.S. is actually one of the leaders in terms of a saturated in contamination because we're an old industrial society. So we have just a ton of neurotoxins everywhere. There's mercury in the air from the cement plants and the coal plants, and it's just here, all right? And we know that when you saturate society with central nervous system toxins, you're going to get what people call behavioral health crisis. It's just one more trigger in a very fast-paced society that puts people under economic pressure, that exposes to people all sorts of violence. We end up with what they call behavioral health crisis. And whether that's because somebody doesn't like your free speech, or your family's in conflict of interest with your free speech, or whatever the pattern is that gets the person who's actually the victim locked up, which is how that happens, you know, the environmental piece is also part of this movie, you know. And I have known, when I've been in a mental hospital, I have known people, deaf people who are there, and they're there because, well, it was inconvenient for their foster family to have them when they were on vacation, so they stuck them in the psych ward. How does that happen? I mean, so when you're there and you meet the people in the psych ward, it becomes crystal clear that these are not perpetrators, these are victims. It's just crystal clear because you talk to them and you find out who's there. And, you know, there's domestic, there's people who like to have to get transferred because their internal injuries from being beat up in their, you know, relationship are so severe that they've got to go into the physical. You know, you got people having like bad reactions to medications. You got people who have lupus, you know, and they're having like disorientation. You got everybody there, and a lot of it's environmental. So I just wanted to point that out and thank Lauren for all that she does.
Thank you. Wow. You know, Lauren, I'm just amazed at the stuff that you've been saying. When you go through life and you go through your little routine, and you don't realize how many people are affected by this. And I hope that you and I can do other shows. And, you know, the stuff that you've talked about, we could expand on. So would you be interested in doing that?
I certainly would. And I would just like to, just before closing, I think that I want to say thank you for calling in and for saying all those things. And I agree with you 100% that these environmental issues need to be addressed, and it's part of it, of what's happening. And in terms of parents' rights, for people to understand, in New York State, there's public health law that if you are found guilty of abusing your child or neglecting your child, you have 18 months to get your child back. In New York State, under public health law, if you have a psychiatric history at any point in your life, you were diagnosed with anxiety, an eating disorder, schizophrenia, depression, whatever, any psychiatric label, which is, and the labels, again, are fraudulent in terms of science, the state is allowed to take your child away from you, even at birth, for zero reason other than the fact that you have a psychiatric history. If your child is taken away from you at that point, you only have 12 months to get your child back. This is a child-snatching situation that it goes with very little attention, although there are some people who have worked for decades trying to call attention to it. But it is a massive issue. Also of a massive issue is the historical and contemporary racist practices of this system. It cannot go without being said for people to understand that in a program like involuntary outpatient commitment, where there's a requirement of having previous institutionalization or previous bad acts, danger to self or others or whatever their language is, African Americans are 3 to 8 times more likely to be court-ordered into involuntary outpatient commitment over whites, 5 times more likely statewide. And the reason for that, after several different reports have come out, including from the New York Lawyers Public Interest and a study that was commissioned by the legislature that was done by the people at Duke University, which is where those numbers came from, what Duke University showed, what's referred to as the Duke study, or Schwartz et al., was that the reason that there is overrepresentation of people of color in court-ordered psychiatry is because there's a mandate that the population that gets court-ordered into involuntary outpatient commitment have a history of institutionalization. And there is clear overrepresentation of people of color in psychiatric institutions. This is another pipeline, like the prison pipeline. It is historical. I would point people to Vanessa Jackson's work, healingcircles.org. In 2001, she did some tremendous historical archival work exposing Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence. His face is still on the emblem of the American Psychiatric Association. One of the diseases he came up with is called negritude. He said that that was what caused the skin to be black, that it was a mild form of leprosy, and it was the justification for segregation of races. And Samuel Cartwright, who came up with two diseases specific to people who were held in slavery. One was drapetomania, a slave who wanted to be free or who tried to run away. And the other was dysgeusia aviopica, a slave who would not comply with the doctor's, with the master's orders or break tools. It was commonly referred to as rascality, which is why little, right. And that the cures for these diseases were whippings, and that whippings would be used preventatively, and in the medical journals there were instructions on the length and the width of the belt, the leather strap that should be used, and the pattern in which it should be a person should be assaulted with it. These historical issues are still playing out. Intergenerational trauma must be addressed. When you have, from a different perspective, when you have a spiritual experience being a legitimate, in psychiatry, an actual symptom of psychiatric diagnoses, denying people's own experiences, values, culture, and certainly spiritual life and spiritual self, these are massive issues. Cynthia, we could do multiple shows on this in the future. But this 37th annual Bastille Day demonstration to break the silence about psychiatric oppression and celebrate the human spirit is just a day that we acknowledge every year. But there are people literally all over the world who are trying to call attention to this every day. And just in terms of those who are locked up or dead from being subjected to psychiatry, just a moment to really reflect on what it means. So the next time you come in contact with somebody, your listeners, who may be talking about having a psychiatric history or maybe in some kind of experience of struggle, to really think twice before you say whether or not to turn to psychiatry as an answer. While it presents itself nice and glossy, the long-term consequences and the iatrogenic effects of being involved both with the drugs and the places that these things occur is massive. So I want to thank you for the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. You have been listening to Dr. Lauren Tenney. She's been on Focus on Albany, and if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany on Twitter. And Lauren, why don't you give a plug for WCAA?
WCAA 107.3, The Arts, Albany, New York, is a place where people truly can have a voice. As a project of Grand Street Community Arts and Activism, it is a brilliant strategy to give power and leverage to everyday people. I know that the station is still looking for people to host shows, to disc jockey, to learn how to do the engineering, to get involved with fundraising. It is such a phenomenal project. Tuesday nights at 6, there is an open meeting at 68 Grand Street. I hope people will come down and get involved, and you can find us at WCAALP 107.3 FM, The Arts, Albany, New York.
Thanks, Lauren. Thank you for taking the time, and I'll see you Tuesday, and thank you, everybody,
great,
for listening. Have a wonderful day. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks, Sylvia. Thanks, listeners. Bye.